book of Daniel contains a lot of mystery, dreams and visions and images, and most frequently our attention is drawn to the book based on some of the stories there. Spectacular stories when you consider Daniel in the lion's den. Well, that can evoke a considerable image of hanging out with a bunch of critters who can tear you limb from limb. And of course, Daniel survived that circumstance, but prior to that, we have the three Hebrew boys in the fiery furnace. I remember growing up hearing those stories and having them etched in one's mind, and you too remember those stories because they have such an impact, such an impression. But I'm afraid that once you get through those stories and rustle around with the ideas of a 70 weeks prophecy and talk about Daniel 11 and how much time the prophecy there covers, so many centuries and so many kingdoms and so forth, I'm afraid that most of us miss major points of the book. So let's take a look at just the first two chapters of Daniel. I will not be so bold as to think I could get through 13 chapters. Let me just check to make sure. I think that's how many there are. Maybe it's 12. That's 12 chapters. 12 chapters of the book of Daniel. But in these first two chapters lay a foundation from which we can extract something about our personal relationship with the God of all creation. And I suspect that people are in wonderment today as to God and His purpose on the earth, what He is doing, and why things seem to be on a grease toboggan slide towards oblivion. Whether in economic circles around the world, in the moral climate of this nation, we are in wonderment, and the fracturing and the atomization of the body of Christ called the church. The first point I would like to make relative to the book of Daniel, and by the way, this sermon is entitled, Here Comes the Judge. Here comes, or as they used to say on Laugh In, here come the judge. Here come the judge. In the 12th chapter, a statement is made. Let's take a look at it. It is a quotation. Daniel is recording it. Ostensibly, he is being told this by God. If you'll take a look at verse 1. Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people. In the New American Standard Translation, the words are a bit different, but the point is the same. He will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. That's an interesting phrase. I suppose that various points of people's lives at the turns of centuries when people thought, you know, the world is coming to an end, or perhaps just simply an eclipse of the sun when the earth was darkened, people thought the end was near. But never, as the times in which we live, is there a comparison to the end of an age. Since the atomic age, the hydrogen age, and the nuclear age, we are in the possibility of destroying all life off the face of the earth, simply by an accident of somebody pushing a button and someone retaliating. But beyond that is the biological and chemical possibilities. A drop of some kind of anthrax, perhaps, or specifically anthrax in the water supply of a city, can wipe out millions of people. That possibility exists. So when Daniel is being told this, would it not be important that we extract from it the possibility that he was talking or given instruction for us today? It goes on to say, such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, Daniel is being told, your people. Now, is he just simply talking about the house of Judah from which Daniel had come, or the children of Israel from which he had also come? Or is he talking about someone else? Look at how they describe this description of your people. Everyone who is found written in the book will be rescued. The book. Doesn't the book of Revelation talk about a book of life into which people's names are written? And I don't think that's a racial or an ethnic concern. So if a person's name is written in the book because he is associated with Daniel, your people, that's a good thing. And so anyone reading this book who would want to conclude that they might be one of those people have to be judged by the standard of the book. We'll get to that in a moment. And many who of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. Now, that's a resurrection, I think he's describing, and that's described in several places in the New Testament, including the book of Revelation and 1 Corinthians 15. Those who are asleep. These to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. A resurrection, a judgment, is to be exerted upon those who occupy the earth. And verse 3, and those who have insight, I wonder if that might include you or me, will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. And those who lead the many to righteousness, those who lead the many to righteousness, how in the world do you do that? Talking to my mother yesterday, letting her know I was going to be up there in Detroit next week, and she got to talking about people calling her on the phone and saying, did you know, this is interesting, did you know that your son is on television? I mean, like, she wouldn't know. Because she hadn't said anything to anybody about it. But did you know? I said, well, what else? Well, they were talking about how pleased she should be. And, of course, with Vance here and my co-presenters, or as we say, speakers, that's what we are. She also referenced the content of one of the programs by Bill Watson as being right to the point about could we have imagined we'd be living in the kinds of days in which we live, when the kinds of things we talk about so openly about what maybe happened in a room off of the White House, I mean, is public conversation. Could we ever imagine that we would be in such a time? But the point is that leading folk to righteousness. See, we're all involved in that. We should be. When people send their offerings and their tithes into this office, it's so that we can lead people to righteousness. That's what we're supposed to be about, not lead people to us. And to have people bowing down and praising us. Because God doesn't need us. Oh no, He wants us. He doesn't need us. So leading folk to righteousness is a part of what Daniel was all about, and those whose names were in the book, that's what they were involved in. They shall be like the stars forever and ever. I wrote a marginal note. Abraham was promised that he would have people so numerous they would be like the stars of heaven, and you could unable to count them. There's a connection here. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book, verse 4, until the end of time. The end of time, the end of an age. Many will go back and forth, coming to and fro on the earth, and knowledge will increase. And have we come to such a time when knowledge has increased? You know, so many years ago, there were people who still assumed the world was flat. Still got a society, a flat earth society, folk who are not very many members anymore, but they still exist. But knowledge has increased, and we have instant access to it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We can plug into the internet and websites and just feed in a frenzy on information. It's called the information age. What better description could be applied than that which we find in Daniel? So the book is written for the last days. But a second point about it is that God shows His great power and plan. And he does it over many, many years. He does it through the Babylonian kingdom and its fall, and then the Medo-Persian empire that followed, with different kings, Darius and Cyrus, being mentioned in the book. But a projected prophecy, when a stone, a little stone, would come along and break this image that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed in the second chapter. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the book shows God's great power and plan. It also shows that God cannot be contained by human limitations. We love to create God in our image. Oh yeah, he looks like us, he walks like us, he talks like us, he's limited like us. And so we don't think that God is able or capable of bringing about his plan in our lives, personally or collectively. We don't think that's possible. And so we govern ourselves in wonderment and lack of faith and puzzling and concern and stirring, sort of like Nebuchadnezzar with his dream that kept him awake all night. God is not limited by human limitations. And then fourthly, the book is about a battle between good and evil. The thing of Westerns, the thing that made John Wayne famous. But God is greater than John Wayne, for God still lives, and John is pushing up daisies, as they say, out of Boot Hill. Now, let's get into the book, back in the first and second chapters, to understand these four points a little better. Nebuchadnezzar was like any wild-eyed, crazy, evil king. In fact, he was as evil as they come. He was a man who had conquered the known world, and he did it in the fashion of the day. He would give a siege or order a siege of a city or a state, if you will. Surround it. Squeeze off the life. It's not an ancient notion. It's not something that is relegated to the past. That's exactly what Hitler tried to do with Stalingrad. Now, and it was called Leningrad then, but he surrounded, he put a siege against the city. Of course, the Russians outlived him in the winter, took him over, and Napoleon tried the same thing to cut off the life supply of a city. That's standard operating procedure. You can do it by what we call today boycotts, or what do we call them now, where you get all the nations together and they say, we won't sell to, let's pick a country out, Iraq. And so we shut them off. That's an ancient idea that Nebuchadnezzar had perfected to the high heavens. And Nebuchadnezzar, you know the whole saying, I came, I saw, I conquered. Nebuchadnezzar put it this way, he came, he blockaded, and he took. And he wound up in the first chapter, we are told, in the second verse, the Lord, I like that, gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. Now Nebuchadnezzar, on the other hand, thought, I did it. The scriptures say God gave this king of Judah into his hands. But that's the way some people think. They think that they are in charge, that they are powerful, sort of like Alexander the Great later on, who had conquered the known world and sat down and wept at the age of 31 because there were no more worlds to conquer. What shall I do now? And what he should have done was sought after the only true conqueror, but he didn't. He died in his sin. Nebuchadnezzar is going to be confronted in the passage of time through this book by the great God of creation. Some people have problems with folk like Nebuchadnezzar because they quickly label him a pagan. He was. No question about that. And God doesn't have any dealings with pagans. So we have a problem in this book, don't we? Because God dealt directly, not through an emissary, but directly with this pagan king. the worst that there was. Let's read on in verse 2. And he brought them, that is, the captives from Judah. This was the siege and Nebuchadnezzar going back and forth to Jerusalem or sending his people back there was over a period of time from the 604 B.C. all the way to finally 586 B.C. B.C. stands for before Christ, but if you're Jewish, it means B.C.E., before the Common Era. When you see that in books, B.C.E., that's what it means. So there was a siege going on over a period of time, and finally, after it all culminated, they were brought to Shinar, verse 2 says. Interesting, Shinar. You think they would have learned. Where is Shinar? It's mentioned in Genesis 10 and 11. Shinar was a town, a fenced city that was created by Nimrod. Long time ago. Before Abraham. Not only that, but it was the plain in which they built the tower, or attempted to build the Tower of Babel. That's where Shinar is. So, this empire, the Babylonian Empire, had a pre-existence. You think they would have learned from that experience that God don't mess with him. But they didn't get it. So now Nebuchadnezzar, following the footsteps of his father, Nebuchadnezzar was his name. His father was that, and they liked to play on the names of gods in their name. Talk about that in a moment. They come down there to Shinar, to the house of his god, Nebuchadnezzar's god. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his god. That was a standard operating procedure. When you conquer somebody, your god is stronger than their god, and you humiliate their god and the people by bringing them and their holy vessels into the temple of your god, because their vessels are now subjected to your god. And your god is victorious. That's why the issue of the battle between good and evil enters into this story. So when we examine the story, they bring, according to the order given to Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles, verse 4, youths in whom was no defect, who were good looking. I like that. They had the looks. And then it's showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding. In other words, they were put to the test. They looked good, and they were tested, and they tested good. So these were folk to be kept. Why? Because when you conquer people such as this, you subject them to your government, your ways, and for 3 years, we are told here in verse 5, they were educated for 3 years in the ways of the Babylonians. The king appointed it. This was a requirement that this be done. In such an appointment, these folk who will be named here in a moment excelled. In a pagan environment, they had to learn the language of Babylon. We make a big deal many times about the paganism in our language, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. These are all names from pagan gods. And we use them all the time, the months of the year. They're all pagan. Here was Daniel and the three Hebrew boys not only learning, but winding up being in control of the kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar. Wow. Is God tough or what? When people get to talking about, come out of her, my people, and be not partakers of their sin, that's what the book of Revelation says. We sometimes cloister ourselves off to such a degree that we never have an influence on the world because they can't find us. We've come out of them so far. And what was said in the book of Revelation is that you come out of the system. That is, you don't become a willing participant in the system. It doesn't mean that you hide. It does not mean that you eschew evil to such a degree that you begin ostracizing people because of a view that they may have that differs from yourself. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't get farther away from God than he was, or the Babylonians. And here is a stark example in the Word of how you can navigate through the pitfalls of the world around in this Babylonian system. Interesting, in the book of Revelation, come out of Babylon is what was being said. Because Babylon is a system that outlived Nebuchadnezzar. Still around today. In fact, some people might say it resides in Washington, D.C., but that's another story. We'll just pass right. They call it the Beltway when you read it, hear about it in the news, the Beltway. It's not like any other place on earth, the Beltway in Washington, D.C. But let's move on. Who are these young men who wind up with great attention? Well, verse 6 tells us that there was Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's their Hebrew names. And those names mean something. And if you were to be taken captive by a system, by a government, by an evil king like Nebuchadnezzar, you know, having a name like they had would be a point of encouragement. Let's look at what their names mean. The title of the sermon is Here Comes the Judge. That's for a reason. Because Daniel's name, it means God is my judge, or judged of God. God judges. Dan, remember Dan, one of the tribes of Israel, was named Dan because it meant judge. That's what he was named. And when you put El with it, which is God or creator, you've got God is judge. That's what it means. Hananiah, I love this name. Hananiah means Yah, right at the end of A-H is pronounced Yah, you know, in our terms. And we know Yah means Yahweh, or short for Yahweh, or eternal, ever living one. Yah has been gracious. Hold up, Hananiah, gracious? You've just been carried off into captivity. How can you bear such a name? How can you receive encouragement from the fact that the Creator allowed the chosen people, as we describe them today, the Jews, to be carried off by an evil pagan king? That must tell you that the house of Judah must have been awful. They must have been sinning to the high heavens. And they were. And they had the truth. So God judged them much more severely than he did the Babylonians who did not have God. But here we're going to find over time that God is going to deal with this most evil world-ruling monarch. Going on with the names, Mishael means who is what God is. El at the end is a reference to God or creator. Who is what God is? That's an interesting question. Who is like God? And Azariah means Yah has helped. He hasn't helped yet. As we're reading through the story, they are captive. They can't go back to Jerusalem. They can't go anyplace. They have been commanded by the king for 3 years to study into the ways of the Babylonian nation. And at the end of the service of which they were to enter the king's personal service, after they have qualified, after they have studied, they had to learn the language, the Akkadian language, as it was called, a different language, but they had many of them, and we will find an interesting point in chapter 2 in a moment. But God finds or grants certain favor to us and to Daniel. Look at verse 9. After the king has commanded them to eat certain foods, he wants them to eat the best that the land has to offer. When you study into the commentaries about this, they puzzle as to why Daniel refused to eat the delicacies and all of the food of the Babylonian Empire and of the king. Well, of course, being a Jew, he was going to be adhering to certain dietary restrictions that was not prevalent in Babylon, you understand. If it moves, eat it. If it grows, eat it. That was their philosophy. So Daniel, wanting to hold back from that, but also to make a larger point, asked for and got favor. Look at verse 9. Now, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. Can you imagine finding favor in the eyesight of a world leader? or somebody high in government. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, imagine it from a local level. How many of you know J.B.? Sheriff J.B. Smith. You know what I mean? Sometimes knowing somebody like that might help in the time of need. You just never know. And I don't mean that you just robbed a bank and you're asking him to hide you. I'm talking about in the time of need. Nice to know somebody who you have favor with, and the favor doesn't come because of the strength of your personality, it shouldn't, but because you're a child of God. Here's Daniel, a child of God, one whose name indicates his knowledge of God, receives this favor, and all he asks from the commander is that, look, we don't want to eat what they're eating. We're just going to eat vegetables and drink water. And let's put a time limit on this thing. Let's do it for 10 days. And if you see a difference after 10 days, then let us continue for these 3 years. And that's exactly what happened. They set up the test. Verse 14 says, so he listened to them in the matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter. I don't mean, you know, rotund, rolling down the hallway or the room, but they were healthier. There was meat on their bones. This was a good thing. And Daniel, in the midst of a very serious circumstance where their lives could be snuffed out by the whim of a great king, had enough nerve and gumption to speak. In a circumstance where their lives could be snuffed out by the whim of a great king, had enough nerve and gumption to speak up. So the overseer in verse 16 continued to withhold their choice food and wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. This is not an argument, by the way, for vegetarianism. But if you're in a circumstance where you can eat good vegetables and good water and so forth, and not knowing what kind of meat you're eating or whether it's got what was the scare up there? What did Oprah say about the beef? She won that trial, by the way. I mean, if you don't know what's in it and you're concerned about your health from that point of view, eat vegetables. It's not a problem. Doesn't mean that one is superior to the other necessarily. But God is in this mix. Remember in verse 2, God gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into bondage here. In verse 9, God granted Daniel. We see God actively involved here. And then in verse 17, as for these four youths, the Hebrew boys, God gave them, he's giving some more things, knowledge and intelligence and every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Oh, that's interesting. Visions and dreams. Is there a difference? Have you, in all your lifetime reading the book of Daniel, ever decided what's the difference between a dream and a vision? Maybe not. A dream, we've all had these, right? A dream, the right kind of dream, can have you waking up in a cold sweat from peaceful sleep, or even waking up not even remembering exactly what you dreamed, but you know it was bad. That's when sleep is fitful, when sleep leaves you. That's a dream. A vision is with your eyes wide open. You know the old song with the ink spot, some of you remember, with my eyes wide open, I'm dreaming. Could it be true? I'm here with you, close in my arms, the song goes. With my eyes wide open. In other words, you see with your eyes wide open something, an image, a story, a vision. That's the difference between the two. And of course, God uses both. In the case of Nebuchadnezzar, we're going to find in the second chapter, he uses a dream. He uses a dream, various dreams with Daniel, but he also uses visions with Daniel with his eyes wide open. He is told or shown great things. Now, continuing here to wrap up the first chapter, it says, in granting this great favor to the Hebrew boys and Daniel, verse 18. Then at the end of the days, 3 years, in which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found to be like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. Wow. God is punishing the children of Israel by sending them off into captivity, subjecting them under a pagan king, the worst that the world had ever seen. One who did not believe in the great God of the house of Judah. And yet, he spoke to these folk after 3 years and was impressed. Can we impress people who are without God like this? I know what you're saying. Well, this is Daniel, though. These are the Hebrew boys. Look at Daniel. He's going to be in a lion's den. And the Hebrew boys are going to be in that fiery furnace. Have you not felt like you were in a fiery furnace somewhere in your life? Have you not experienced being in a lion's den where you don't know if you're going to survive? You've never had that feeling? If you have, you can identify with this story. You can identify with this account. And we must begin to look at it like that rather than the spectacular, the 70 weeks prophecy, and this symbol means that, and that symbol means so and so forth. All that's well and good. But if you have no relationship with the Creator, you have nothing. That's what this book is about. Personal relationship with God. Not mastering and majoring in minor subjects like what prophecies are going to work out. Because sometimes when the prophecy comes to pass, you might find out the door is shut and you can't get in. Sort of like people scratching at the ark. Noah, can you open up? No, God's got the key. You can't get in. So we have to wake ourselves up to this fact. Now, verse 20. And for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And you're talking about Babylon now. Babylon, the mystery religion, as the book of Revelation describes it. It was the seat of every nook and cranny. Babylon was older than Egypt. Egypt had stolen or borrowed from Babylon many of its mysterious things. You know that Nimrod, who built the city of Shinar, where Babel was built, was said to be Osiris in the Egyptian religion. That's how significant Babylon is. A symbol of the worst of the world. Well, verse 21 is a kind of a capstone that says Daniel continued into the first year of Cyrus. Oh, wait a minute. Don't run by that too quickly. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. The Medo-Persian Empire hadn't come yet. I believe Cyrus was a Persian. So this is many years of yet to come, but this summation verse, Daniel continued. God is able to cause his people to survive through the worst of things. And as a church, we ought to come to realize that God is able to cause us to survive the worst of things. It's hard for us to do that, though, because we look at stuff. We look at situations. We look at lions, tigers, and bears. Oh, my. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. The Wizard of Oz. You didn't get that reference. It's a powerful story. Oh, by the way, I shouldn't hurry by verse 7 in the first chapter where the Hebrew boys and Daniel's names were changed, because it's part of the story, this battle between good and evil. Now look at it for a moment. Shadrach. As I said, when they brought the vessels from the house of God in Jerusalem to the house of Nebuchadnezzar's God, it was a standard operating procedure. They did it through African history of the tribal wars and so forth, of conquering one nation and bringing their gods and subjecting their gods to the gods of the new tribe, if you will. I suppose it's sort of like America conquering Japan and democratizing it. That's what happened after World War II. They westernized them. They brought democracy. Why do you think they wear suits today instead of the kimonos and the things they used to wear? Because we conquered them, and you know the great god they had was the emperor. Well, they still have an emperor, but he's not nearly as important as he was before America and its president put them on the run. So there are modern parallels of this kind of thing. We must remember it. But the point is, here in verse 7, the names were changed, and they were given pagan names. Shadrach. There was a god, a moon god, a Sumerian moon god named Aku. And apparently Shadrach's name comes from a word, Shadru Aku. Shadru Aku. Shadrach is the what we call the language corruption. And it means command of Aku. This god will command me, Aku, the moon god. He will command me. That was the name he was given. But when you read the account, you find, yes, a reference to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but you also have that Hebrew reference to their real names. What about Meshach? Interesting. Meshach Aku. That's part of the name, too. It's sort of like, it's interesting that his name in Hebrew, Mishael, meant what? Who is what God is? Well, in the Babylonian tongue, his name meant who is what Aku is? The pagan god, the moon god, Meshach. And I always have fun with Abednego, you know, the big bad Negro. I just love that. Abednego. I mean, just kind of interesting point there. We've had fun over the years, but Abednego comes from Abednego, which is a kind of a corruption of another god. Actually, it was the god of Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabu. Nabu. And it simply means servant of Nabu, god of wisdom. So they were given these pagan names, and yet they maintained their relationship with God because of what their names, their original names, meant. Sometimes in going through new configurations, new circumstances, people get a little discombobulated. They get to wondering, well, is this the same? Or are we wandering off down the wrong path? And what's going to happen? Well, I got to tell you that at some point in time, faith has to be activated. Just like with Daniel and the Hebrew boys. It had to be activated. And it hadn't even kicked into high gear yet. We haven't gotten to the fiery furnace yet. We have not gotten to the lion's den yet. And yet they've got to exhibit some faith right now. Second chapter. Long chapter. 49 verses. No, I won't read every verse. But there are some important things to consider in this chapter because it contains a dream. A dream. 30 years ago, a man spoke of having a dream in Washington, D.C., at the Lincoln Memorial. We all know about the dream and the dreamer, and oftentimes when people have dreams, they quote from Genesis about Joseph and his dreams. He had dreams. It's a way that God communicates sometimes with us. The fact that Nebuchadnezzar, the world-ruling king here, is going to have a dream is significant. It says in verse 1, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. This is important to know that it was actually his third year. But his first year was an ascension year, a year of preparation before you actually start counting. So sometimes we find contradictions in the book of Daniel as to time reckoning, and it's because we don't account for that year of ascension. Well, it shouldn't be mysterious to us. Our presidents are elected in November, and they are not sworn into office until January, but there used to be a time when we didn't swear them in until March. And yet they were the president-elect. Nebuchadnezzar was the king-elect for a whole year prior to his legitimately becoming king. And so sometimes the reckoning of the time things are thrown off a bit. But it says he had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Wait a minute. You're the baddest of the bad. You've conquered everything in sight. Your treasury is full. You've got soldiers all around, personal bodyguards, palaces galore. What yet do you want? Your choice of women? You got everything going, and you can't sleep. Later on, the first king of Israel, Saul, was to have a problem with dreams. Couldn't sleep. Brought David in to play on the harp, to calm him down, to satisfy him a little bit, to give him peace of mind, because it doesn't matter who you are. It does not matter who you are. God, the Creator, can get to you. He can take everything you have, or he can give you a dream. And this dream upset him significantly. So, make a long story short, he calls together all of his highfalutin people, who was supposed to know, brings them in, says to them, okay, I had this dream, verse 3. My spirit is anxious to understand the dream. And when you're a hired servant like this, people wonder, well, what about all the people around the president or the prime minister, all the people that he hires them and hires to surround him for advice and counsel and so forth? Why is it that they can't get him to do right? Why can't they counsel him to do right? Well, because first of all, as is illustrated here, when you're the king, most people say to you, O king, live forever. They bow down to you. It happens in churches. It happens in businesses. It happens in government. It's just how it is. It happens in families. O king, live forever. They didn't really mean that, but that was a common expression. Well, from verse 4 to the end of chapter 7, the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic. Aramaic is a language kin to Hebrew, and it's interesting that the rest of that, this prophecy and a series of other events are written in the Aramaic language. So when you go back to the manuscripts, you will find this to be true of the book of Daniel, that right here in verse 4 of chapter 2 all the way to chapter 7 and verse 28 is written in Aramaic, because the language is the lingua franca of its day. It's the official language of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians, and also a language that Daniel was quite familiar with. After all, they had studied for 3 years to learn of various languages, but this was a language they knew. O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. I had a dream book to bring in to you, and I forgot to bring it in. It's called the Kansas City Dream Book. Those who have ever played illegal numbers before all the states started getting lotteries, you know, there were dream books, several kinds of dream books, to which a dream or an ingredient of a dream was given a number. Some cases a 3-digit number, some cases 2-digit numbers, and you can work with these numbers according to your dreams, and you play that number. You bet that that number is going to fall. This is a modern deal that is around that goes all the way back to these soothsayers and these dream consultants and these sorcerers. And so all they wanted to know from the king is, tell us the dream, and we will tell you what it means. But the king says, I don't remember what the dream was. Uh-oh. You don't remember what the dream was. If you don't know what the dream is, how are we going to tell you what the dream is? This, of course, is God doing battle as the good agent versus the evil. He is going to bring down all of the intelligentsia of the Babylonian Empire, including the king himself, through these 4 Hebrew boys. 4 against a nation? An empire? Are you kidding me? Well, yeah, that's exactly what we've got going here. So no, you tell me what the dream is, and you interpret it too. And they said, well, the second time in verse 7, you've got to tell us the dream. We will declare the interpretation. The king says in verse 8, look, I know what you're trying to do. What you're trying to do is buy time. Inasmuch as you have seen the command from me is firm, that if you do not, in verse 9, make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare it for interpretation. Verse 10, the Chaldeans, that's exactly where Iraq is today. Chaldea, that's that region. Doesn't mean that they're necessarily descendants of these same people, but could be. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could declare this matter. For the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this, they've all played along. Tell me, I'll tell you the dream, and you tell me what it's about. Remember in the movie The Ten Commandments, when the Pharaoh has got all the people surrounding him, his counselors and his philosophers and his people, and of course God denuded the Egyptians by destroying all of their gods in the ten plagues. That's the kind of God we serve. That's the kind of God we must become knowledgeable about. Well, moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, they said in verse 11. We can't do it. But the decree went out. Kill them all. And unfortunately, in the mix of all of this, Daniel and his Hebrew boys had been elevated to this same rank of counselors, and therefore the decree was also for them that they should die, that they should be killed. Daniel replied in verse 14 with discretion and discernment to Arioch. I find that interesting. Sometimes we get so high up in ourselves because we know when the Sabbath is, we know when the holy days are, we think that we got it going on. And we lose discretion. We lose discernment. We don't know how to talk to anybody. We don't know how to get a point across or how to converse. Here's Daniel showing us by example with discretion and discernment. He talked to the king's chief bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. The commander, Arioch, told him exactly what the decree was. And so Daniel went in to the king in verse 16 that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Well, that's interesting. So verse 17 through 23, Daniel and his friends prayed and received help from the God of heaven. Maybe in the time of trouble, that ought to be tried. Maybe. To actually pray to the God of heaven. And look at how he prays with the boys, with his buddies, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In order that they might request compassion from God of heaven concerning the mystery so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Let them be destroyed, but not us. Because we will do what we will have to do. Then, in verse 19, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Well, what kind of thing is that? Again, why eyes wide open, seeing clearly, panoramic view. God gave to Daniel what he had troubled Nebuchadnezzar with so that he would be able to go to Nebuchadnezzar the king and not only tell him what the dream was, but the interpretation thereof. Look at how he praises God here in this verse 19 or verse 20. Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever. For wisdom and power belong to him, not to me, Daniel. There are some people who look at the book of Daniel and, oh yeah, this means so and so, and I can quote you this and long chunks of it, and wow, ain't I great? Ain't I grand? Just look at me. And yet, Daniel, to whom God gave so much, says, you are great, not me. All praises belong to you. And it is he who changes the times and the epochs or the eras, and he removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you. Reminds me of Psalm 34, verse 1, where the psalmist says, my praise, or thy praise, shall continually be in my mouth. Maybe out of our mouths should come more praise in the midst of trouble, in the midst of difficulty. Well, the rest of the book, of this chapter rather, goes through in verse 27 through Daniel begins to talk to the king about the mysteries and so forth, and verse 29 through 45 gives a revelation and the interpretation of the dream. Well, you know the dream. This is one of the things we remember from the book of Daniel, this image of the various kinds of metal, and ultimately this stone that comes along and strikes the image on the feet and destroys this whole system that emerges. And historically, people look back and say, oh, we know what these things are now. Daniel didn't have names for the Roman Empire or the Medo-Persian Empire or the Greco-Macedonian Empire. He didn't have names for them. They didn't even exist yet. But historically, retrospectively, we look back and say, well, you know, the head was Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, and then the chest and the arms became the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medes and the Persians got together, and then following them came the Greco-Macedonian Empire with Alexander the Great and all of that, and then those two legs were divided off into different deals, and the Roman Empire came after that, and then there will be a revival of the Roman Empire with the 10 toes and all that, and we go through all that stuff retrospectively. Daniel was given directly from God exactly what he was to tell this Nebuchadnezzar, the king. I suggest that in that kind of revelation, God is able to deal with us today. And Daniel, because of his being submitted to this God, in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of being carried away captive, in the midst of being subject to even a death penalty, God blessed Daniel and the Hebrew boys. How much? Verse 46 through 49. Verse 48, the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. He made him ruler of the whole province of Babylon, chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Now that is some high stepping in the midst of great paganism and a king who had not accepted God as his God. And he has some rough days ahead. This wasn't even a rough day yet. He's going to have to later on munch grass like a cow in his wild state of mind after another dream comes to him. So when we, as we go through a series here, and this is just the beginning of a series going through the book of Daniel, let us think. Let us consider what God did with Daniel and the Hebrew boys he can do with you and me. In the midst of great difficulty and trouble all around us, we must recognize that God is judge. That's who the judge is. Not the Supreme Court, not the Congress, not somebody else or some other organization. God is judge. And once we come to realize whom we serve, then we, like Daniel and the Hebrew boys, can walk on the high places of this land. May we come to appreciate that and embrace it.